In the summer of 2014, the world watched in shock as ISIL captured Mosul, Iraq's second city, and took control of territory the size of Britain. The brutal approach of terrorist groups in Iraq and Syria was not new. However, the main reaction of the West came when ISIL brutally beheaded American and British citizens in front of cameras.
Could be sent to Iraq as soon as tonight, although not in a combat role.
Is there a threat to the British people?
British Prime Minister David Cameron denounced them as psychopaths, but he failed to point out that Britain has a long history of involvement with such groups and has been prepared to ally with them when it suits the interests of Britain.
We will expand our support to the Syrian people and the Syrian political opposition with an extra £5 million in non-lethal practical assistance.
Just months before they captured the world's headlines, ISIL and similar groups fighting in Syria had benefited from funding by key Western allies such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and from weapons supplied by the United States and its allies to Syrian Takfiri terrorists. From this building, Secret Service agents were monitoring the movements of supporters of terrorist groups traveling to Syria and Iraq. The question has to be asked, why was no action taken in the past? I want to see if the rise of Takfiri groups is an unprecedented development, or as has been said by many authors, academics and journalists, that there has been a complex history of British collusion with and promotion of groups remarkably similar to today's ISIL. In my search for finding the possible answer to such a big question, I wanted to be bold and straightforward, so I wanted to see if Britain was or still is promoting Muslim sectarianism and colluding with Takfiri terrorists.
Not only are the British government colluding and collaborating and enabling and funding and arming extremist groups, they always have been. It has been a tried and trusted British imperial tactic.
It's understood that if Britain did not create the concept of divide and rule, but has been one of its most sort of promoter, and indeed it is part and parcel of the foreign policy of United Kingdom.
One of the methods by which they have divided and ruled is to foster extremism in the hope, belief that they can control it.
George Galloway!
Equally bloodthirsty jihadists that we are giving money, materiel, political and diplomatic support to in Syria. Has the Prime Minister read Frankenstein? And did he read it to the end?
If he had read it to the end, he would discover that when you make a monster, by the end, it's out of your control.
A very important British government document from the 1920s quotes the British politician Lord Crewe on this very policy of divide and rule. This was of paramount importance to Britain at the time. In his book, The Birth of Saudi Arabia, Gary Troller quotes the document, which reads, "What we want is not a united Arabia, but a weak and disunited Arabia split into little principalities incapable of coordinated action against us."
This is an imperial strategy that's been going on for hundreds of years. Empires rule large parts of the world in part by creating conflict. The British and the French in Africa and the Middle East and elsewhere, this was always the strategy. You pit groups against each other, you get them vying for power. You sort of solidify identities and make them very self-aware of different competing identities, and then you fuel it with arms. And you support this group one day, and then you support another group the next day, and then you create this kind of instability.
In the First World War, control of the Middle East was a key worry for Britain. Here, the divide-and-rule policies were taking shape, so straight lines of borders were drawn to create new states. The Sykes-Picot Agreement, secretly signed in 1916 by Britain and France, was the fruit of this policy. Based on this agreement, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq were established. To secure these policies, Britain made a series of promises to Sharif Hussein bin Ali, who ruled in Mecca, that if he raised a revolt against Ottoman rule, Britain would champion the creation of a pan-Arab state in the region. T.E. Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia. Right after the First World War, he stated that when war broke out, an urgent need to divide Islam was added, and we became reconciled to seek for allies rather than subjects. The seeds were sown for the various crises which have affected the region ever since. The shoots and foliage of these seeds are what we see today as brutal Takfiri groups.
After the First World War, the British Empire was most concerned about Arabism, about Arab nationalism that might unite the Arab world from the Atlantic to the Persian Gulf. That would definitely have been the end of empire if that had occurred. So they happened upon the bright idea of fostering Islamist extremism as a counterweight to Arab nationalism.
Britain rewarded Sharif's family by installing his sons as kings of Jordan and Iraq, both effectively run by London. But as ruler of the holy places, Sharif had ambitions to become the new caliph, a position left open by the end of the Ottoman Empire. Such an ambition threatened Britain's dominance because it did not want any ruler to grow too strong. British interests were preserved only by division and conflict.
Well, there were already contacts during the war between the Saudi dynasty and the British. But essentially, after the war, there were two conflicts between, in a long ongoing struggle for hegemony in the Arabian Peninsula, between the Hashemites, so Sharif Hussein, and the Sauds. What's going on with the British, really, particularly in 1923-24, is the playing off of one semi-client against another.
Once more, London used divide and rule and switched its support from Sharif Hussein to his rival Abdulaziz ibn Saud. John R. Bradley noted down in his book, after the Arab Spring, Ibn Saud founded the extremist Wahhabi kingdom in 1932 with full British blessing. The House of Saud had adopted a preacher, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, in 18th century CE. Abdul Wahhab essentially purported that all developments in Islam since the death of the Prophet were blasphemous and argued for a return to what he termed pure Islam. He told his followers regarding any Muslim who didn't accept his teaching that they should deprive the man of immunity, of his property, and his life.
Very like ISIS, by the way. If you study the tactics of Abdul Wahhab 200 years ago or more, you can see without the YouTube, without the film and the photographs, you can see exactly the same tactics followed by Abdul Wahhab of extreme terror, really horrifyingly extreme terror, deliberately deployed in order to terrify the opponents, make them run away.
In his article, written in the summer of 2014, Alistair Crook quotes the official historian of the Saudi state, writing about the Wahhabist capture of the holy city of Karbala in Iraq in 1801. He proudly states, "We took Karbala and slaughtered and took its people as slaves. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds. We do not apologize for that and say, and to the unbelievers, the same treatment. Several thousand Shia Muslims were butchered."
Saudi Arabia, the ruling family is Wahhabi, And the Wahhabi sect is known for its sectarianism, and the foundation of that sect is to be extremely violent against other Muslims whom they deem to be kafir or not following the path that they name.
The British ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Willie Morris, reported in 1968 to Foreign Secretary Michael Stewart, under the title of British Policy Towards Saudi Arabia, that it is in practice an instrument for whipping up interest and support for Saudi Arabia.
Britain's relationship with Saudi Arabia is the darkest corner of this whole picture. The brute character, sectarian, extremist character of Saudi Arabia is so obvious to anyone with eyes that want to see. It is incredible, frankly, I mean literally incredible, that Britain can profess openly to have such close relationships with it.
The state drive was in open carriages to the palace. King Faisal rode with the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh in the first carriage.
So that the King can ride down the Mall in an open carriage with Her Majesty the Queen, when he would never allow a woman in his presence in normal circumstances. When his regime, I mean, they talk about ISIS beheading people. The Saudi regime has beheaded one person every single day in the month of August, a record.
The way that Saudi money has been used in educational establishments and